you burn an even higher proportion of fat. This is because with every subsequent interval, you require more and more oxygen for both the work and recovery portions. This means that you slide further and further toward the aerobic systems and use both fat and carbohydrates to rebuild the creatine phosphate and ATP needed for the next interval. However, you can still maintain higher levels of activity than would be possible during aerobic training at a constant pace because the recovery periods allow replenishment of ATP and creatine phosphate and removal of waste products. The bottom line is that more energy is used, with more and more of it coming from aerobic use of fat. And one last happy thought. The more you train, the more fat you burn during recovery. As good as it is, intense interval training isn't for everyone. It must be customized for people with certain orthopedic problems or serious heart conditions. Again, my advice is to check with your physician before starting this or any other exercise program. And please, before you do any exercise, listen to the next chapter, Boomeritis, the New Epidemic, to make sure that you're exercising safely. Fringe benefits. Okay, you know that exercise can boost your metabolism and help you burn more fat and calories, but here are some other wonderful benefits you can get from working out. Enhanced sex. If you want to get in the mood, get out your running shoes. Numerous studies have linked regular vigorous exercise with more frequent sexual encounters and enhanced sexual enjoyment for both sexes. A 2003 study of male health professionals found that men over age 50 who were physically active reduced their risk of erectile dysfunction by 30%. A study conducted at the University of British Columbia found that 20 minutes of intense exercise appeared to stimulate sexual response in women. About 15 minutes after a workout seemed to be the optimal time. Maybe couples should consider doing their workouts together. Increased energy. Think you're too tired to exercise? The problem could be that you need to get off the couch. Researchers at the University of Georgia analyzed 70 different studies on the impact of exercise on more than 6,800 subjects. The bottom line, 90% of the studies reported that when sedentary people completed a regular exercise program, they experienced more energy and less fatigue compared with people who did not exercise. Better brain power. Around age 40, the human brain begins to shrink, causing age-related changes in mental function, such as memory problems. Until recently, we believed that an aging brain couldn't make new brain cells. We now know that it's possible to make new brain cells well into old age, but there's one catch. You have to work at it. Specifically, you have to do your cardio. A study of 60 to 79-year-olds conducted at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign found that when people did 1 hour of aerobic exercise 3 times a week, their brains actually grew. More brain cells translate into better mental function. Yet another reason, it's smart to exercise. Longer lifespan. Exercise can add years to your life, according to a 2005 study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. Researchers examined the medical records of more than 5,200 men and women who participated in the Framingham Heart Study, a groundbreaking study that has gathered information on diet, lifestyle, and health over a 40-year period and is still ongoing. People with even moderate levels of physical activity gained up to 1.5 years of life, and those who did more intense exercise lived on average 3.5 extra years. My belief is that not only did the more active people live longer, but they probably enjoyed a much better quality of life. Chapter 5, Boomeritis, the New Epidemic. From my discovery of baseball at the age of 5, I have always loved sports and have played just about all of them. Unfortunately, as I got older and spent more time in the office and at the hospital, pickup basketball, softball, and touch football gradually faded into oblivion, except for occasional games with my two sons. My major athletic endeavor became tennis, which I played competitively in my youth and spent summers teaching. I also jogged on a regular basis, and had for years, and did short spurts of ice hockey, yes, ice hockey in Miami, karate, and rollerblading. About 10 years ago, I gravitated to golf. I had to give up some of the more taxing sports because as I got older, I tended to get nagging injuries, particularly shoulder, low back, and knee pain. I was not alone. Not surprisingly, the preponderance of such injuries among baby boomers like me has come to be known as boomeritis. About 3 years ago, I began doing core training with Chris Belding, the Pilates teacher who designed the core functional fitness part of our exercise program, and I was amazed at how much better I felt. My overall strength and flexibility greatly improved. I felt younger, and I stopped experiencing the boomeritis aches, pains, and injuries that previously seemed to occur on a regular basis. And I finally fulfilled one of my mother's longtime admonitions, stand up straight. While I was at home in Miami Beach, I had no trouble following my usual exercise and diet routine. But like so many people who travel a lot for business, I wasn't always as diligent on the road and occasionally gained a few pounds during my travels. I didn't always follow my own advice about being prepared with healthy snacks. Also, I found it difficult to put enough time into a cardio workout that was necessary to complement my core training. Fortunately, about this time, I was lucky enough to meet my collaborator on this book, Dr. Joe Signorelli, who teaches exercise physiology at the University of Miami. Joe told me about the benefits of interval training and convinced me that I could burn more calories and achieve a higher level of fitness in a shorter period of time than I was currently spending on my workout. While I had heard about interval training for competitive endurance athletes, I was unaware of its potential for the rest of us. I reviewed the scientific literature he suggested, and I became convinced that interval training for non-athletes was an important advance. The beauty of interval training, which, as I explained in the last chapter, involves doing short bursts of high-intensity exercise followed by an easier recovery period, is that you can do it wherever you are and adapt it to any activity. As fate would have it, about the time I met Joe, my friend and patient Mel was raving about his experience with boxing. I knew that Mel had boxed as a teenager and was surprised to hear that at age 72 he was back in the ring, albeit with a trainer. Mel's wife, a former professional dancer, and I had been trying to get him to do regular exercise for years, but he was quickly bored by conventional workouts. I was delighted when I heard that he had kept up his boxing lessons for more than a year, and it showed. His energy level had increased immensely, and his blood chemistries, blood pressure, and weight all reflected the benefits of his time in the ring. Those of you who are unfamiliar with boxing may not know that it's one of the most demanding of all sports. In fact, boxing is possibly the ultimate in interval training, with 2 to 3 minute rounds of intense exercise followed by a rest period. I had always heard that boxers were among the fittest of all athletes and was curious to give boxing a try as a way to work intervals into my own cardio program. I was referred to a fabulous boxing trainer, Lewis, and began working with him. But before I go further, let me put in an important disclaimer. What I did with Lewis was baby boomer boxing. Lewis held up hand pads and directed me on when and how to punch them. He was not allowed to punch me back. What I learned was a progressive choreography where my skills and fitness improved at a fast pace. Within a few months, I was floating like a butterfly around the ring. I was also clearly burning more calories in less time than during my previous long jogs or walks at a steady pace. I was thrilled with my progress and improved fitness. But then I made a big mistake that led to injury, pain, and an unfortunate break from exercising. In fact, it's what inspired me to write this chapter of warning for my fellow boomers. At the end of our sessions in the ring, Lewis and I would do some classic boxing exercises using a medicine ball. This was fine until I did a repetitive move of lifting, throwing, and catching the heavy ball over my head. Almost instantly, I felt a sharp pain in my left shoulder. But instead of stopping at that point, I disobeyed the advice I always give to my own patients. I ignored the pain and continued with the over-the-head exercise. Over the next few days, the pain in my shoulder got worse. When I went to the doctor, I didn't even have to see him before my problem was identified. His wife, who was assisting him, was recording my medical history. When she heard about my medicine ball escapade, she immediately told me that she often heard her husband advising patients my age, and even those quite a bit younger, not to lift weights overhead, and especially not repetitively. It was now clear to me, even before it was confirmed by the doctor and an MRI, that I had joined the crowd of my peers who had sustained a rotator cuff injury. The orthopedist explained that with age, there is simply less room within the shoulder joint because of normal calcification that occurs as a result of general wear and tear, and this room is compromised even more when we lift weights overhead. The result is trauma within the joint that tears the rather delicate rotator cuff muscles. This injury, at least temporarily, ended my nascent but promising boxing career. It also put a major crimp in my golf swing and the quality of my Pilates training. Fortunately, I didn't require surgery, and after about 6 months of regular visits to an outstanding physical therapist, I returned to pain-free exercising. As I describe my experience to many of my patients, it seemed that half of the men and a third of the women I saw had also experienced rotator cuff problems. Many had required surgery, and almost all had learned the nothing heavy overhead lesson. I was really sorry that I hadn't had that important piece of information earlier, when it could have saved me from my own injury. During the time that my exercising was severely limited, I noticed another ailment. My wrist was hurting. Was this arthritis? No, it was carpal tunnel syndrome, a problem many of us boomers and pre-boomers developed by spending long hours typing on computers. In an informal survey of my patients and friends, carpal tunnel syndrome, like rotator cuff injuries, seemed to be occurring in epidemic numbers. And a quick review of the medical literature confirmed how common carpal tunnel syndrome has become in our post-industrial society. I'm not telling you these stories to discourage you from exercising. The alternative is far worse. Being sedentary increases your risk of developing many of the illnesses known to man and woman, including arthritis, cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's. I'm telling you this so you don't make the same mistake I made. If I had known not to lift heavy objects repetitively over my head, I'd still be boxing today. The problem wasn't the sport, it was the way I trained for it. It doesn't matter what activity you're doing. You could be playing tennis, lifting weights, jogging, or ballroom dancing. If you do foolish things like ignore pain, as I did, do too much before your body is ready, ignore previous injuries, or don't train properly for your sport or activity, you will get into trouble. An injury-prone generation. As more and more baby boomers heed the advice of their doctors and engage in various modes of exercise to stay fit, there is no question they are becoming increasingly vulnerable to injury. Boomeritis is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. According to a 2006 article published in the New York Times, sports injuries were the number two reason for visits to a doctor's office in the United States. Only the common cold accounted for more visits. and orthopedists are reporting a surge of injuries among middle-aged athletes, weekend warriors, and wannabes. Why are we injuring ourselves in record numbers? One reason is that many people who have not exercised for years or who have never exercised before and who are poorly conditioned have suddenly decided to make up for lost time. They join a gym and start running too fast on a treadmill or lifting too heavy weights, or they go for long jogs outside on hard pavement. On one hand, it's wonderful that so many people are inspired to start or increase a fitness program. On the other hand, this enthusiasm needs to be tempered with appropriate caution. Whatever form of fitness you pursue, it's a good idea to begin slowly so you don't get injured. There's a reason our fitness program, which you'll learn about in part two of this book, is a three-phase program. During phase one, which you do for 2 weeks, or longer if need be, you gently ease into an exercise routine, making sure your body is ready before you move on to the next phase. Once you're in phase two, you will become stronger and more flexible, ready for an even more challenging workout. And once you've mastered phase three, you will know how to work your body in a safe, healthy way, and you'll be able to integrate the concepts of the program into your own fitness regimen if you like.
Living the South Beach Diet. Diane and Mark C., both age 58. A diet we can't stop talking about. My husband, Mark, and I have been following the South Beach Diet for more than a year, and we are so excited about our weight loss. We never stop talking about the diet. Over the past year, I have lost 38 pounds, dropping from 170 to 132. My husband lost 50 pounds, from 240 to 190. I started the diet first, and within 2 weeks shed 8 pounds. Mark said he'd never go on a diet, but when he saw how well I was doing, he decided to join me. He lost an incredible 22 pounds over the first few weeks, and believe me, we didn't starve ourselves. I am a big eater, so the puny servings that most diets call for don't satisfy me. But on the South Beach diet, I ate until I was satisfied, and it sure worked for me. Before going on South Beach, my husband was quite the junk food junkie and a big beer drinker. Diets were never for him. He hated them. Today, he's a totally reformed eater and thrilled with his results. He's good about following the principles of the South Beach diet. Sometimes he'll ask me, "Am I allowed to eat this?" He now realizes that he can have his cake and eat it too, but not all the time, and not so much. I had tried many diets, but always ended up gaining more weight than when I started. This time, it's different. I actually went on an 11-day cruise and didn't gain an ounce, but ate very well. I had eggs for breakfast and ate nuts and veggies when I was snacking or hungry. For dinner, instead of having the ship's decadent desserts, I'd ask for some fresh berries. The most amazing thing about the South Beach diet is that it isn't complicated, and you can always eat well, no matter where you are. Mark and I are both 58, and we had always heard that it's harder to lose weight as you get older. The South Beach diet made it easy.
Too much, too late. I'm a cardiologist who sees people every day who have heart disease or who are at risk for it. But sometimes I feel more like an orthopedist. I always take an exercise history from my patients because it is such an important part of their cardiac status. What I invariably hear is a litany of complaints characteristic of boomeritis: low back pain, rotator cuff pain, hip, knee, wrist, ankle, and neck pain, tennis elbow, Achilles tendonitis, and shin splints are the most common ailments cited. The good news is that almost all of these are preventable. The problem is that many people, even the very fit, are not doing the right exercise for their bodies, especially their midlife bodies. For example, I see far too many knee and hip injuries in my practice, often among runners, In fact, I have rarely seen a baby boomer who runs regularly on a hard surface who has not experienced knee, hip, and or low back problems. Many of these people continue to run even though their joints are tender and painful. I tell them that they can keep their running shoes, but it's time to do more joint-friendly exercise, at least part of the time. I also see a fair number of people who simply overdo it when it comes to exercise. Instead of giving their bodies a needed break, they keep pushing themselves harder and harder, farther and farther, to the point of injury. You can get away with running for miles every day on a hard surface when you're in your teens or 20s, but by the time you hit 40, I don't recommend it. The human body was never meant to sustain that kind of beating. If you do want to continue running, I urge you to do an interval training program and run fast for only short periods of time with adequate recovery periods, and if possible, avoid hard surfaces. And it's not just runners and middle-aged athletes who are exposing themselves to overuse injuries. Let me share another of my personal boomeritis experiences. About 10 years ago, I attended the annual American College of Cardiology meeting in New Orleans. I stayed at a hotel about a mile away from the convention center where the meeting was held. I walked to and from the center and then walked for miles within the convention center. Great exercise. 2 days into the meeting, as I hiked back to my hotel, I began to notice pain and tenderness in my shins, which seemed to get worse with every step. Just as I thought I couldn't walk any further, I spotted a shoe shine stand and decided that I needed a shine and a rest. As I sat down, I complained to the shoe shine man that my shins were really aching. He observed the thin-soled loafers I was wearing and quickly made the diagnosis of shin splints. I was clearly not the first conventioneer who had sought refuge at his stand because of shin pain. Dr. Shushine quickly prescribed a well-known brand of rubber-soled shoes. Though I had long ago learned to wear thick-soled running shoes when I jogged, it had never occurred to me that I should be wearing them for walking or that shin splints wasn't a malady suffered only by runners. I bought the recommended shoes and have walked long distances at many heart meetings since, without a recurrence of shin pain. Still, too many others continue to pound the pavement one way or another without proper precautions, and they're paying the consequences. It's not surprising, then, to learn that experts are predicting that the number of knee and hip replacement surgeries will soar as baby boomers reach their later decades. A study published in 2007 estimates that there will be 3.48 million total knee replacements performed in 2030, a 673% increase from the number performed today. The study also predicts that there will be 572,000 hip replacements performed in 2030, a 174% increase from today's number. This does not mean that you should not exercise. While it's true that many of these spare parts will be going to aging athletes who overwork their joints through the years, even more will be replacing the severely arthritic joints of people who may not have done enough exercise. A sedentary lifestyle can lead to being overweight or obese, and that, too, puts undue stress on the hips, spine, and knee joints. Even a small amount of weight loss can save your knees a lot of wear and tear. With every step you take, you impose a force of from 3 to 6 times your body weight across each knee. A 2005 study published in Arthritis and Rheumatism found that for every pound of body weight lost, there's a 4-pound reduction in stress to the knee joint. Considering that you work your knee joints every time you stand or walk, the lighter the load, the better. The point is that overdoing it, as well as doing nothing, will lead you to the same operating room. This is why everyone needs to incorporate joint-friendly exercise and recovery periods into their fitness routines, and the earlier, the better. Smart Fitness. As it happens, many, if not most, of the boomeritis complaints I see in my office, including rotator cuff injuries and low back pain, aren't the results of sports injuries. Rather, they occur in people who are just going about daily chores, like bending over to strap a child into a car seat or picking up a bag of groceries. While some of these injuries are simply the result of weak core muscles and poor flexibility, I also see these problems occurring in the fittest of my patients, or at least the ones that look to be the fittest. This gets me to another important point. Many people who think they're doing smart workouts may be doing themselves more harm than good. Conventional weightlifting, sometimes called classic gym, can be counterproductive because it tends to isolate muscle groups and train them in a manner that is not naturally functional. In other words, the workout does not mimic everyday human activities, and it usually neglects the core muscles. The result is muscles that look good in the mirror or on the beach, but aren't much help when it comes to injury prevention or performing active sports or day-to-day tasks. The best exercises you can do to prevent boomeritis injuries are called functional exercises. These exercises, which are similar to movements you execute in your daily life, require you to use several muscle groups in one fluid movement. That's why, in addition to cardio conditioning, our fitness program emphasizes functional fitness to strengthen your core and peripheral muscles. For example, when you lean over to pick up a child or lift heavy bags of groceries from your car, you're not using just your arms and legs. If you did, you'd be overusing these muscles, leaving them vulnerable to injury. When you bend over to pick something up, you're engaging all your muscles, including legs, midline, back, and arms. The core muscles support all your other muscles and help you maintain strength, good posture, and balance. You may be surprised to learn that as a cardiologist, I place as much importance on core strengthening exercises as I do on cardio conditioning. The fact is, because this type of exercise promotes stability, strength, and flexibility, it's essential for preventing injury and maintaining a healthy weight. And if you suffer an injury and you're in pain, you're not going to do an effective cardio workout or any workout at all. In my practice, I see all too many patients who are no longer able to exercise due to injury. The importance of functional fitness has only recently become appreciated. During my travels, I visit many gyms or fitness rooms associated with hotels where I stay. I have noticed that more and more of the people who are exercising, with or without a trainer, have incorporated functional fitness into their workouts. I am pleased to find both women and men lifting hand weights while sitting on exercise balls or using pulley-type machines or standing on balance boards, which all require them to engage their core muscles as they work other parts of their bodies. Watch the Core Busters. Of course, our ancestors didn't have to worry about setting aside time to perform muscle flexing and strengthening exercises to maintain fitness. They accomplished this while going about their everyday routines. Anthropologists tell us that cave dwellers had remarkably strong muscles and bones thanks to their normal daily activities. Hunting and gathering was hard work. Stalking and killing prey, and finding and picking fruits and vegetables provided a full body workout. And if you injured your back, you might not survive. Even our very recent ancestors were more physically active than we are. Before society became industrialized, just getting through the day was physically challenging for both men and women. Chopping wood, tending the garden, scrubbing floors, washing clothes on a board or a rock, and hanging them up to dry, all involved full and functional body movement. Today we drive to work, take an elevator to our offices, and sit at our desks all day long. We now use the remote control not just for our TVs, but for our sound systems, DVD players, lights, and even curtains. Our kids aren't running around after school, climbing trees, and playing sports like we used to, because they're home playing video games. Our modern civilized world has created what I call core busters, because they prevent our core muscles from getting the activity they were meant to experience. Muscles that aren't used become weak and stiff, and weak, stiff muscles lead to further inactivity, a sluggish metabolism, and eventually injury. Stop sitting, start moving. We all need to be more aware of the core busters in our everyday lives. Exercising for a few hours a week is great, but we also need to think about what we're doing the rest of the time. Are we just sitting around, or are we active and moving? Do we walk up the stairs or take the elevator? Do we hail a cab when we could walk? It turns out that the movements we do throughout the day, both consciously and subconsciously, burn calories and strengthen muscles. And these calories really do add up. Dr. James A. Levine from the Mayo Clinic has popularized a concept called NEAT, an acronym for Non-Exercise Activity Thermogenesis. NEAT reflects all the calories we burn when we are not sleeping, eating, or doing formal exercise. In a study published in 2005 in the journal Science, Dr. Levine and his colleagues compared NEAT in two groups of people who did not formally exercise. Half were thin and half were obese. He found that the thin subjects who frequently got up from their desks to walk around or stretch, paced while talking on the phone, or just fidgeted, were on their feet during the normal daily routines for 2 more hours than the obese subjects. This translated into burning 350 extra calories per day, enough to explain the difference in weight between the two groups. In another interesting perspective on the importance of NEAT, Dr. William L. Haskell of the Stanford Prevention Research Center estimated that spending 2 minutes per hour sending emails rather than walking down the hall to speak with a colleague resulted in a 10-pound weight gain over 10 years. Wow, maybe switching my office to paperless by using electronic medical software wasn't such a good idea after all. The unfortunate fact is that over the last 100 years, the proliferation of labor-saving devices, from the automobile to electronic software, has decreased NEAT by between 500 and 1,000 calories weekly. And this drop has clearly played an important role in our epidemic of obesity. But the impact of NEAT on our society, while disturbing, also presents an important opportunity. We need to plan our workplaces and our daily routines better to make up for all the energy expenditure we have lost because of the activities we no longer do. NEAT is wonderful news for people who believe that the only way to stay trim and fit is to run marathons. Walking when you could be riding, standing when you could be sitting, and moving when you could be keeping still are easy ways to stay slim and strong for life. More important, maintaining a healthy weight and doing the right exercise is your best insurance against boomeritis. Following the South Beach Diet and South Beach Diet Supercharged Fitness Program can help you achieve both of these goals painlessly. And when your spouse or a friend tells you to sit still and stop fidgeting, just say no. Chapter 6. Bye-bye belly fat. If you've had trouble zipping up your favorite pair of jeans lately, or had to loosen your belt a notch or two, then beware. Your expanding waistline could be upping your odds of having a heart attack or stroke. In fact, it could even kill you. One of the most important benefits of the South Beach diet is that as you lose excess pounds, you also lose inches, especially around your midsection. Women tell me with great pride that for the first time in years, they can wear dresses with waistlines. And some even boast that for the first time in their lives, they can wear bikinis. Men are equally thrilled that when they take off their shirts at the beach, they can show off their tight abs instead of a bulging belly. While this is great news for those interested in the cosmetic effects of a diet, it's even better news for those concerned with avoiding a heart attack and improving their general health. Walk down a busy street almost anywhere in the United States today, and you will readily observe that not all overweight people have the same body shape. Some look more like pears, and others look more like apples. If you'd been keeping account of overweight individuals over the past few decades, you couldn't help but notice the shocking increase in overweight, apple-shaped Americans. In these individuals, excess fat is concentrated in the belly, whereas in pear-shaped people, most fat is concentrated in the hips and thighs. Ever since French physician Jean Vague first distinguished the android, apple-shaped form of obesity, from the gynecoid, pear-shaped form, in 1947, and observed a connection between apple-shaped obesity and the development of diabetes, hypertension, gout, and atherosclerosis, research has continued to demonstrate that the health implications of body shape are more important than we thought, even just a few years ago. It turns out that belly fat is different from fat that accumulates directly under your skin. Belly fat is the fat within the abdominal cavity. It's the fat attached to organs such as the stomach, liver, and intestines. These internal organs are called viscera, and that's why the fat that attaches to them is known as visceral fat. Visceral fat is like an endocrine organ, producing hormones and other chemicals that have a spectrum of biological effects on the body. And as we shall see, it is these hormones and chemicals that are slowly killing us. The proliferation of apples. Why is our country populated by so many more apple-shaped people, and why should we care? It turns out that the proliferation of apples in America, and increasingly around the world, is a human survival mechanism gone awry. Understanding this mechanism will help you appreciate what has caused the fattening of America, how it is hurting our health, and what can be done about it. For early humans, the accumulation of fat during times of feast acted as a fuel reserve that could be called upon for survival during famines. If this fuel reserve was concentrated in the belly, leaving the arms and legs leaner, then a person could still run and hunt without limitation. Consequently, it would be a survival advantage to eat more than normal hunger dictated when food was plentiful and build up this fatty fuel reserve. To use a contemporary analogy, early man protected himself by filling up an accessory gas tank in his belly. When food was abundant in summer and fall, he might fill up the tank by consuming more than was required for his immediate needs. Then he could gradually empty the tank as needed during winter months when food was scarce. This survival mechanism worked fine for millennia. But today, most of us live in the midst of a constant feast without intervals of famine. The hunger that once helped us to store fat in order to survive continues unabated. The result, we've become fatter and fatter and fatter, and many of us also have become pre-diabetic and diabetic. You may be wondering why in the midst of this constant feast we aren't all overweight apples. The reason is fascinating. It turns out that the genes that encourage fat storage, what are called thrifty genes, aren't distributed equally among societies around the world. Those societies that have experienced subsistence living, punctuated by famine in recent times, have a generous dose of thrifty genes. If they move from their traditional diet and lifestyle to a Western diet, however, they almost always become obese. One such society that has been extensively studied is the Pima Indians in the southwestern United States. For centuries, these people barely survived in desert conditions. Their ability to store fat easily when food was available and use it in time of scarcity was a crucial survival mechanism. But in the later 20th century, when the Pimas moved from their traditional lifestyle to a Western one, they experienced a horrible epidemic of obesity that continues to this day. This, in turn, has led to devastating rates of diabetes, early heart attacks, and strokes. Today, Eastern Indians who move to the United States and adopt a fast food diet have the same problems. But they no longer have to move to the United States to experience obesity and diabetes. In New Delhi, and even Beijing, where Western fast food restaurants are beginning to proliferate, these health problems are becoming more common. But what about our friends who seem to be able to wolf down large amounts of fries and soda and remain thin? Well, these individuals were born with fewer thrifty genes and are blessed with a genetically rapid metabolism, a great boon in modern times. If it makes you feel any better, in prehistoric times, these genetically thin people may not have survived. So, depending on our genetic heritage, we each have a different propensity for accumulating belly fat and becoming an apple or a pear. The yin and yang of belly fat. Why is belly fat a problem beyond the cosmetic? Overall, the hormones and other substances produced by visceral fat are pro-inflammatory. At first glance, this would seem to be good, since inflammation is an important means of fighting disease. For example, if you cut yourself or are invaded by harmful bacteria, your inflammatory response is called upon to first stop the bleeding with the formation of a blood clot, then fight any invader by mobilizing white blood cells to neutralize the bacteria or wall off a foreign body. In appropriate amounts, visceral fat and the inflammatory substances it produces are essential for survival. In fact, when it's not present in adequate quantity, such as in starving third world children or those malnourished from cancer or another chronic disease, the inflammatory and immune response underperforms, increasing the risk of infection and death. When our fat stays turned on. What happens if we persistently have excess visceral fat? What if our inflammatory response is turned on when we don't need it? What if it's on all the time? Because we have become a country of apples and our excess belly fat is continually pouring out inflammatory substances, we are now seeing its unfortunate effects. We're discovering that there are additional inflammatory chemicals produced by this excess fat, and we're learning more and more about how they affect the body. One such substance that's frequently mentioned in the medical news is C-reactive protein, CRP. This protein particle, which can easily be measured in clinical practice with a blood test known as a high-sensitivity CRP, hsCRP test, is appropriately elevated when there is infection in the body. But it has also been found in dangerously high levels in people with belly fat, prediabetes, and diabetes. Overall, studies show that we Americans have 20% higher levels of CRP than our British cousins. And it is this and other research that indicates that we are indeed a hyperinflamed society. Dr. Paul Ritger and his colleagues at the Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention at Harvard, who did the initial research on CRP, have taught us that elevated levels of CRP are a risk factor for heart disease, and that chronic inflammation is intimately involved in atherosclerosis, the buildup of fatty plaque in our arteries that leads to the blockages that cause heart attack and stroke. But we are only now realizing that the scourge of inflammation goes well beyond affecting the heart and blood vessels. In recent years, we have learned that inflammation appears to be a common denominator behind numerous other diseases, including diabetes, Alzheimer's, macular degeneration, asthma, arthritis, and many forms of cancer. Belly fat and inflammation also appear to play a role in such common conditions as acne and psoriasis. Belly fat equals inflammation. Why should inflammatory substances be associated with belly fat? It turns out that an inflammatory response requires energy. If early man was starving, he could not afford the energy expenditure needed for an inflammatory response. All his energy was required just to bring blood and nourishment to his organs. This trade-off meant he was vulnerable to death from injury or infection, and is probably why our inflammatory response became associated with belly fat. The presence of belly fat in our forebears ensured the fuel reserve that was required for the protective inflammatory response. The fact is, humans were never intended to be carrying around the excess fat so many of us are lugging around today. So how does this early survival mechanism translate to how we live today? The presence of excess belly fat in such a high proportion of our population is unprecedented. Because we never before had so many inflammation-producing apples, we didn't understand the extent of the health implications until recently. Just look at the heart disease deaths, which had been decreasing over past decades due to improved treatments and better prevention. This favorable trend appears to be reversing itself in America's younger age groups. A study published in the November 2007 Journal of the American College of Cardiology showed that in Americans between the ages of 34 and 55, the very ones who've had the greatest exposure to processed and fast food, deaths from heart disease are on the rise. So are the incidences of prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, two other diseases directly associated with belly fat. Thus, it appears that a sedentary fast food lifestyle is trumping even our impressive gains in the treatment of the number one killer of men and women. If things continue as they are, when the current XL generation gets older, matters will be even worse. Why your BMI can be misleading. Body mass index, BMI, is a formula for measuring optimal weight. It uses your height to adjust for your weight, as it compares you to other individuals and populations. For instance, two men may weigh 200 pounds, but if one is 5'5" and the other is 6'2", then weight alone is obviously a very poor predictor of which one is in fact overweight. BMI is the most common method of classifying normal versus overweight versus obese individuals. If your BMI is between 18.5 and 24.9, you're considered to be in a healthy weight range for your height. If your BMI is between 25 and 29.9, you're considered overweight. And if the figure is 30 or greater, you're considered obese. To determine your BMI, just use one of the quick BMI calculators available on the web. While BMI has been a more helpful measure of obesity than weight alone when it comes to comparing obesity rates in two different cities or states, it can be a misleading indicator of health in individuals. That's because BMI does not take into account the distribution of body fat. Remember, fat concentrated in the belly is much more dangerous than fat concentrated directly under the skin. For instance, you might have a professional athlete with a great deal of muscle mass who has an elevated BMI but little belly fat, or a severely overweight person with a high BMI who has fat predominantly concentrated under the skin. Both of these people may well be at low risk for prediabetes, diabetes, and heart disease. Conversely, you can have someone with a normal BMI who carries a dangerous amount of visceral fat in a pot belly. That person's BMI might be normal because of thin arms and legs and little weighty muscle, but that person is nevertheless at increased risk for heart disease and many other diseases as well. So if BMI can't accurately predict if your fat is dangerous, what is a more accurate measure? The answer is your waistline. Two measures of waistline are commonly used. One is simply your waist circumference measured where it is smallest, usually just above your belly button. The waistline circumference cutoff for the diagnosis of prediabetes in a woman is 35 inches and in a man, 40 inches. The second measure is the ratio of your waist circumference to your hip circumference, known as your waist-to-hip ratio. To find it, measure your hips at the widest part of your buttocks, then divide your waist circumference by your hip circumference. For example, if your waist is 34 inches and your hips are 32 inches, divide 34 by 32. Your waist-to-hip ratio would be 1.06. If your ratio is greater than 0.95 for men or 0.8 for women, you fall into the apple-shaped category, and it's time to do something about that potentially lethal belly. The diabetes-fat connection. I cited this statistic before, but I want to mention it again. Today, 40% of Americans between the ages of 40 and 70 are pre-diabetic. The prevalence of pre-diabetes has tripled over the past several decades, and today, most patients in coronary care units are pre-diabetic or diabetic. The cause of these burgeoning problems goes back to our fat storage survival mechanism, which rather than being life-saving, has become harmful in modern times. As it turns out, it's the accumulation of visceral fat that leads to insulin resistance, the condition in which the body produces enough insulin, but the cells can't use it properly. The cells are in fact resistant to the action of insulin. As I noted earlier, insulin resistance causes the exaggerated swings in blood sugar that can in turn cause hunger. Without periods of food scarcity, this hunger leads to further fat accumulation. And the more fat you store around your midsection, the bigger your belly fat cells become. The problem is that insulin does not communicate effectively with swollen fat cells after a meal. As a result, the pancreas has to keep producing extra insulin to overcome the insulin resistance of these larger cells and move sugar and fat from the bloodstream into the tissues. Eventually, the pancreas becomes exhausted and cannot produce adequate insulin. When this happens, blood sugar remains elevated after meals and type 2 diabetes is diagnosed. Clearly, what helped man survive in the past is killing us today. Luckily, we now understand why, as a nation, we've gotten so fat and hyperinflamed. And luckily, we now know what to do about it. Don't worry, I'm not suggesting that we all starve ourselves or try to imitate those times of food scarcity or famine. But in some ways, we all do need to eat more like our ancestors. This means consuming more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, healthy fats, and lean protein. These are the basic tenets of the South Beach diet, and following them will reverse our accumulation of belly fat and its detrimental health consequences. The other thing we must do is move more, the way our ancestors did. This means regularly doing aerobic, cardio conditioning, and functional core exercises. In fact, studies show that exercise is one of the most effective ways to get rid of visceral fat. In a 2005 study conducted at Duke University, 175 overweight men and women with mild to moderately bad blood fats were randomly assigned to participate for 8 months in one of three exercise groups. The participants were instructed not to change their eating habits. One group exercised at moderate intensity, 45 to 50% of aerobic capacity, for approximately 3 hours per week. The second group exercised at a high intensity, 65 to 80% of aerobic capacity, for 2 hours a week. The third group exercised at the same high intensity, but for 3 hours per week. Both the 2 hour high intensity group and the 3 hour moderate intensity group showed no further accumulation of visceral fat. But the best news was that the high intensity group, that worked for 3 hours per week actually showed a significant decrease in visceral fat. And the bad news for couch potatoes, a control group that didn't exercise showed a significant increase in visceral fat, which means that if you do nothing to stop it, visceral fat just keeps on growing. Another study published in 2006 in the International Journal of Obesity found that a combination of diet and exercise, not diet alone, reduced the size of abdominal fat cells. This is an extremely important finding because swollen fat cells are the ones that become insulin resistant. Shrinking abdominal fat cells can help restore a normal insulin response, which will help prevent prediabetes. What about pears? What if you're a pear, a person who carries fat mainly in the hips and thighs? Will you respond as well as an apple to a proper diet and exercise? The answer, unfortunately, is no. It will, in fact, be harder for you to lose weight than it is for your apple friends, because like most pears, you have a slower metabolism due to your genetic makeup, not your diet. That makes metabolism revving exercise even more important for you. But there's good news, too. As a pear, you are much healthier than your apple friends, who may weigh the same as you. It turns out that overweight pears don't have the thrifty genes that lead to fat storage in the belly. A word about metabolic rate. While most of the epidemic of obesity has been due to activation of the fat storage survival mechanism discussed before, this is not the cause of all obesity or overweight. Even before we began this unintentional experiment of eating the wrong foods and avoiding exercise, there was still a percentage of Americans who were overweight. Many claimed they didn't overeat, and it turns out that many of them were telling the truth. In contrast were the food-guzzling types who never gained a pound. The fact is, we all have different metabolic rates, and these rates do affect whether we gain weight readily or not. This point was made quite clearly in a famous Canadian study of twins. In the study, 12 sets of identical twins were overfed by 1,000 calories a day, 6 days a week, for 100 days. The amount of exercise was carefully monitored and exactly the same for all. In other words, all the participants had the same energy intake via food and the same energy output via exercise. By the end of the study, each set of twins had gained virtually the same amount of weight, but between different pairs, the weight gain varied from about 9 to 28 pounds. This study proved that a major contribution to weight gain is metabolic rate, which is largely genetically determined. It's an important fact for dieters to understand, because your metabolic rate will affect how you respond not only to diet, but also to exercise. But don't be discouraged if your metabolism is slow. It doesn't mean you should throw in the towel and stop trying to lose weight. You'll just have to be a little bit more conscientious about maintaining our diet principles and work a little harder at your exercise routine.
Living the South Beach Diet. Alan Jay, age 52, finding his own fountain of youth. In May 2006, my cardiologist told me the results of my latest blood work, and they weren't good. My lack of exercise and love of beer, fried foods, and lots of ice cream had finally caught up with me, and I had a beer belly to show for it. I weighed 250 pounds, and my blood sugar was 140. That was much too high. I'm 6'3", so I always thought I could eat whatever I wanted and get away with it. Even a trip to the emergency room for chest pains 3 years earlier wasn't enough to make me take care of my health. I thought that all I had to do was take drugs for my blood pressure and cholesterol, and I would be fine. I was wrong. My cardiologist told me that I was a sugar cookie away from entering the pre-diabetes stage. I immediately thought back to when I was in the ER. I had seen a man whose leg was so black that I thought he was a burn victim. The nurse told me that he would be losing his leg the next morning, thanks to diabetes. When my doctor told me I was a candidate for prediabetes, I was finally scared enough to take action. My doctor had been trying to get me to read the South Beach Diet for more than a year, but I resisted because I thought it was just for women. But that day, I followed my doctor's advice and finally got a copy. The book made a lot of sense, explaining why some foods do what they do to your body. The testimonials gave me hope that the diet would work for me. So, like any other red-blooded American male, I immediately decided to start the diet. In a week. That gave me 6 more days to go on a farewell binge, in which I'd eat all my favorite foods. In that week, I managed to pile on another 5 pounds, and my waist grew another inch or so, to a size 42. I was really afraid of phase one and saying goodbye to all my comfort foods and beer. What really helped was keeping the book close at hand to refer to when I needed it, along with the support of my wife in making all